something wrong. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Mary Thayer. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
It's really a privilege and an honor to be here. I want to thank this committee. I especially want to thank you, Bill. This past week, I was speaking someplace, and I ran into Roger. So Roger and I were talking, and he said, I'll see you in Augusta, even though the thing says that I'm from New Mexico, which I do live there part of the year, but I also live in Florida. So it's just a Florida group here speaking, I guess. So anyway, I ran into Roger, and Roger said that. And I said, did you get a lot of notice about this conference? He said, I know. It went on and on. So this is really amazing. You know, I must have gotten 10 calls, 10 letters. It was wonderful. It really was. I got to tell you, it was lovely. And I've been treated very nicely and have really appreciated Miss Jessica. It was really kind of funny. She was going on telling me how she'd wrecked a car and blew out a clutch. And I said, you want me to drive? I also want to tell you how nice it is to be here and see some really wonderful friends that I haven't seen for quite a while. I think that's one of the gifts of this fellowship, is that we do meet lifelong friends, and we do kind of walk shoulder to shoulder to escape disaster together. A couple of those friends are our tapers, or CD people, I guess you call them nowadays. They're really great people. I've known them for a lot of years, and it's a wonderful service that they do with these CDs. There's some people that I know very, very close to me that actually sobered up listening to CDs in another country. So it's an honor and a privilege to know them and to be part of this fellowship. I identified with all the speakers, but the Al-Anon speaker said today that this was the last thing she wanted to be doing. Boy, I identify with that. I really do. Yeah. I had sponsorship that said to me that I had to just do everything just once, find out what I was supposed to do and what I was supposed to be. And I had the honor and privilege of speaking with an Al-Anon lady the second time I ever spoke, and I was such a wreck. I thought I was going to die. And it was down in Brownwood, Texas, and it was a woman-to-woman conference. And this lady, her name was Rusty Kelly. She was just a dynamite Al-Anon lady. She passed away in a car accident, actually. But I remember she looked at me finally, and she said, you know, she said, Johnny Harris told me that my phone won't ring unless God wants you to talk. And I've never forgotten that. So I don't know if this talk is for you or me. Let's see what goes on. I guess I'll tell you a little bit about my drinking. But I really feel as though I'd like to stay in recovery today. Let's hope I can get there. I was raised Boston proper. That's where you're hearing the accent. You people who have accents, I do too. So even though the flyer says I'm from New Mexico, I'm really from just north of Boston. And I was raised in a very lovely place. A lot of money, property, and prestige that divert you from your primary purpose. But for a long time, I said I really wasn't raised with any religion. And one time I was speaking someplace in North Carolina, and I said, you know, I wasn't raised with any religion. But, you know, I did have a religion, and that religion was money, property, and prestige. You ever think about that? How much does that really come before? It was amazing. Anyway, I was supposed to be seen and not heard, and that's very hard for a curious kid. And I was curious. And so, you know, I didn't do what I was supposed to do, and I, too, got sent away. You know, they get rid of you if you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, I guess. I don't know. And I was sent up to a little prep school up in Maine. And I do believe, by then I, you know, there was always, the sun was over the yard someplace, they used to say. And I was raised, my dad had a boat and stuff, so alcohol was always going on. So now I must have been about 13 years old, and I think back on this and I realize this was probably was not normal. But I am, as they were driving me to this prep school, they had to put me in it halfway through the year because I was running away by then. And I knew already how to con to get what I wanted when I wanted it. And I knew they were feeling guilty. And so I would say to Dad, do you think you could stop and can we get some of this cider on the side of the road here? Now, I knew at 13 that you can't buy apple cider from the store because they have some kind of a preservative and you can't make hard cider out of it. Do you know that? Now, Dad would stop and say, okay, I'll get you some. And I'd say, can't I have 2 gallons? Because the minute I get in the dorm, you know, the kids drink it. He said, okay, I didn't share that, you know. That was my stash. And so when you look back and when did I start drinking, I don't know. I just, it was very similar to what was talked about here. When I drank, I felt as though I was part of. When I wasn't drinking, I felt as though I was apart from. And I drank because it made me feel as though I was okay. I didn't feel all right inside. And if I would still be drinking if it still worked for me, but it ceased to work for me. And what happened for me is that I left that prep school. I was a little rebellious, and I decided I would join the Water Follies, which was definitely not proper, according to the folks. And so I joined. And, you know, I could swim better than I could walk, thank God, because that's where I really started to learn how to drink and how, what it did for me. It did a lot for me. It really did. I had a good time with it. I really did. When I left that group, my father said, you're not waiting for another show to start. You're going to get some kind of a job. And so I ended up working for his company in Boston. Real big job. Anyway, so because my father could come in to work at any time he wanted to, I got a job. I got a place to live over in Harvard Square. And I met one of the gals that I graduated from the prep school with over there. And these nice young men came to say hello to us in this coffee shop. And I liked one of them. Really cute. And unfortunately, I did something, you know, I got pregnant and married in that order, which isn't very proper either, you know, but that's my story. So I was about 19 and I had a daughter. I was really a child having a child. And I married a man that I always say, you know, water seeks its own level. And he was an alcoholic, and he wasn't the fun type of alcoholic. And so our weekend guests were usually the local police. Because I was what they call nowadays a battered wife. And that was not an easy time for me. It was kind of a real shock in reality. The longer I stayed pregnant, the more I couldn't drink. And so reality was kind of cruel. It really was. After having that child, there was an awful lot of the disease of alcoholism that was happening. When my daughter was about 8 months old, it was a very physical morning, and I was quite bruised, and my former husband picked up my daughter and took off, and then he had a little TR3. Does anybody remember what those were? We didn't have car seats in those days. And I remember looking out the window as he drove off with my daughter in that car, and there was like a moment of clarity. I said, I can't expose her to this. And I left him, and I remember calling my mom and saying, Mom, can I come home? And she said, I've been waiting for this call. I don't know why she never asked me what was going on, but I mean, you know, who knows, it probably wasn't proper. So anyway, this family brought me back into their lovely home. And then I think the progression of alcoholism set in. And what happened from there was is that I found that when I drank, I did not have to tell you about what had happened to me. Because it wasn't necessarily the thing to be talking about on the yacht club porch, let me tell you. And so I started using alcohol to stop that. And my folks, I got a job and I came home, and as soon as my daughter was in bed, I'd say, I'll be out. And they'd say, well, okay. And then when they realized I wasn't coming home when I was supposed to be coming home, they told me I had a curfew and I had to be home at 10. Well, my God, that was still happy hour to me. And, you know, and I did not understand the progression of alcoholism had already set in. And that even though I had said that I would be home at 10, there was no way I could ever stop until that last call came. And then absolutely said, set them up. And if there was a party after, that's where I was. And I remember one morning I came back to that home. And my mother looked at me and she said, I'm so sorry, Mary Thier, but we cannot keep you here. You have got to leave. And I know it broke her heart to say that. You know, she didn't have any Al-Anon. Do you know that? But they did definitely had tough love. And thank God. And thank God, that's all I can say. So I left that lovely place and drank at them in that town until my reputation caught up with me. And then I did what any good alcoholic does. You take a geographical cure. And so I decided that I had a half-sister that lived in Southern California, and I had a friend that flew for, I think it was United, and she said, oh, California's great, why don't you come? I said, okay. I packed up that four-year-old child, and I left for Southern California. Now, I spent 5 more years drinking, and by then my progression had gotten to the point that I had the shakes. So bad, in those days, in order to get a job, you had to take a typing test. And I couldn't even keep my hand on the keys, let alone anything else. I didn't know what was the matter with me. And my half-sister said to me, why don't you go see my doctor? And I did, and he sent me to a psychologist. And the psychologist said to me, do you think maybe that you could be alcoholic? And I said, no, I don't drink that much. What's that much? I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. I mean, what is he talking about, alcoholic, you know? And he gave me this wonderful little pill called Valium. Oh, it's wonderful. Do you know that? And I would come home and drink myself to oblivion and pass out. When I came to, I would take one of those things, and the vicious cycle started. And for the last 5 years of my drinking, I can tell you bits and pieces of it, but I was a blackout drinker. I thought everybody blacked out. I didn't know. And I would come out of these blackouts yelling at the only thing I loved most in this world was that child. And I decided, finally, I said, oh my God, I can't be doing this. And I had good reason to stop. But instead, I decided that I would become a bar drinker so that she wouldn't have to see me. I'll tell you, we're nuts, aren't we? And so there was a little gal that lived in the apartment building. I was there in North Hollywood is where I was. And she was a teenager, and I asked her if she would babysit. And I said, I'll be home in about an hour or so after work. And this is kind of the pattern that goes on. You know, you stop to have the drink, then you call the babysitter and you ask if they'll watch the baby a little longer, blah, blah, blah. Finally, after probably the third or fourth call, she would say to me, why don't you just leave her overnight? I'd say, oh, thank God. And, you know, and then I would get down to drinking the way I wanted to drink. Several times I ended up in the hospital, and they'd just fill me full of more Valium and send me home. I was sleeping with a knife between my box spring and mattress to ward off something that was trying to get me at night. I later found out it was the DTs. I had no idea. No idea what was going on with me. Just so happened that one night I called and the babysitter said, just leave her overnight. And the next day I walked over there to pick up my daughter, as I had for a long time. And the mother answered the door. And she looked at me and she said, Mary, I really don't know you. Why don't you come in here and sit down? I'd like to chat with you and get to know you. And I thought, well, this is probably a proper thing to do. And so I got in there, and she proceeded to tell me her story. And she'd been raised in New England. She'd gone to MIT. She was an engineer over at Lockheed. And I'm thinking, good stock here. This is good stock, Boston proper. And and then she said something very strange. She said, and I'm an alcoholic. I said, you are? And she said, yeah. She said, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Really? And she said, yes. And she told me her story. And when she was done, I looked at her and I said, you know, I think I know a lot of people who could use that program. She said, we have open meetings. I said, you do? And she said, yes. And she said, there's one tonight, so why don't you come? Now, I tried to tell her I didn't know if I'd have a babysitter. She assured me that that would be no problem. I remember going to work that day, and my boss said, how are you? I said, well, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. I said, what? I said, yeah. And they said, well, let us know. They already knew if I left in the afternoon. If they said, if I was going to lunch, they said, are you going to lunch with the other? I said, yeah. I said, we'll see you tomorrow. I mean, they already knew that that was the way it was with me. So that night I arrived at her house or her apartment, and she had a sponsor that had told her she had to do something. That's what she said. My sponsor said I had to go here, so I can't take you, but my husband David's going to take you. I said, okay. And this gentleman said to me, let's go. And we went to this meeting, and it was a Friday night. It was the Winnetka meeting in the valley, and I walked in. It was a speaker's meeting. And as I walked in, David introduced me and said, I want you to meet Mary. All these people came in kind of like you folks. You look pretty good, shine up pretty good. It's open meeting. I guess everybody's from the streets have come in to see what AA is about. I didn't know what it was at all. And they said, we have literature. And somebody gave me these literature things. And one person said, this is 20 questions. And I said, okay. And they said, don't answer it now. Sometime when you're alone, answer these 20 questions. I thanked them and sat down. And one woman came in a little late, and she sat down next to me. She said, hi, are you new? And I said, no, I'm just visiting. And then they started the meeting. And it was very similar to the one I went Monday night. It was a little bit more, really. They have one over there in St. Pete that's kind of like this. They have something called birthdays out there. Instead of anniversaries, I don't know what, do you call them birthdays here or do you call them anniversaries? You never know all around the country. Well, and I was looking at this thing, and they called these people up, and they got a cake, and then they sang out a key, and they just laughed, and they just, it was very entertaining. I thought, this is interesting. It was not what I perceived an AA meeting would be all about. And after that was all over, they had this woman come up to speak, and she stood at the podium, and she said, my name is Sybil, and I'm an alcoholic. Turned out Sybil was the first woman alcoholic in the state of California. And that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And as she spoke, I remember sitting next to David, and she would say something, and I would be laughing hysterically, as everybody was. And the next minute, I would have something in my throat, and I'd want to just be sobbing. And, you know, it's not proper to be showing any emotion. You're not even supposed to laugh loud. I mean, really. And so I couldn't understand what was happening to me. And at the end of the, after she finished talking, I remember David turned to me and he said, how do you feel? I said, I could cry. And he said, go ahead. And it was almost like floodgates started. And I started sobbing. And I had no idea what was happening to me. It wasn't until later that I understood that was the first time in my life I had been given a permission to have a feeling. It's the first time I'd ever been told, go ahead and cry. You know, stiff up a lip if you're from New England. And he walked me up to Sybil and he said, Sybil, I want you to meet Mary. It's her first meeting. And she turned around and she looked me in the eye and she said, welcome home, honey. And she wrapped her arms around me. Now, I know a lot of people don't come in thinking they're home. But I want to talk about why I know what that meant and why it meant to me, what it did. And that was September 13th, 1973. And I have been forever home in the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous for the past 43 years. I absolutely love this program. I told you the home I was raised in. It really wasn't a home. I was raised by nursemaids. I was sent away. I was not feeling welcome. And then when I got married, and you know, every little girl has a dream about the white picket fence and all the little family, and it sure wasn't that. It sure wasn't that. And yet there was something in Sybil's eyes that went right through the facade or the wall or the mask that I had developed in order to survive as a woman who was an alcoholic, who was a mother and a drunk. And I knew, and I had a mask, and I was so, so not who I was. I was such a false self, and that's who I presented to you. And yet when Sybil turned around and looked me in the eye and said, welcome home, honey, she went right through that mask. She went through every single layer there was and into my soul. And she touched it. And she did know. She did know how I felt. I didn't know that night. All I knew was that I couldn't understand what I was feeling. I didn't understand that I had been someplace that I had felt safe. I had felt connected. Chuck Chamberlain, I had the honor of listening to many times, and he would say something. We come into these halls, he would say, and he was disconnected with himself, with God, and with you people. And that's exactly how I came in. I had a hole in my gut and the wind was blowing through. I didn't know what was the matter with me. I was scared to death of everything and everybody. I was drinking just to survive. I didn't even know how to be a mother. It was insane what was going on. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I remember Rosemary was the woman that 12-stepped me in, actually. And she used to have that bumper sticker, Easy Does It. And I remember I'd be parked behind her, trying to get out of the parking lot. And I'd be looking at that sticker and going, what the heck does Easy Does It mean? I don't think anything's easy. And, you know, it was like all of this energy came at me. There was a presence, a loving God, as he expresses himself in our group conscience. There was a presence that I felt at my very first meeting. So on the way home from that meeting, I remember David said to me, if you are alcoholic, Mary, it is a progressive disease. And he says, it's kind of like riding a bus. You can get on the bus and you can go all the way to Skid Row, or you can get off right here at North Hollywood. That's going to be up to you. You might want to try us. Why don't you come over and have a cup of coffee with us tomorrow morning? And he left me, and he brought my daughter home, and I put her to bed, and he left me with a big book, whatever that, I didn't know what that was. You have your own lingo here. It's really kind of funny in a way how we just talk at people and they don't know what we're saying at all. And, you know, and he left me with that. But I remembered those 20 questions, and that night I answered those questions. And at the very end it said, if you answer three or more yes, you're an alcoholic. And I was looking, I thought, well, that's sneaky, because I'd answered 17 yes. And I'm an alcoholic. And I had just come from a place that I had felt so much that I had never had ever felt before. The next morning I went over there and I walked in and Rosemary said, how'd you like your first meeting? And I said, well, I think I'm alcoholic. And she said, yes, I've been waiting for you for a year and a half. Now this is what you're going to do. And she proceeded to tell me what I was going to do. And, you know, don't drink, 90 meetings, 90, gladly refund you your misery, all that. And, you know, and she said, now, are you on any drugs? And I said, oh, I don't do drugs. She said, you're not on any, what's that other one, Librium and Valium? I said, well, I have to take Valium. And she said, that's a dry drink. Well, I didn't like her at all. I just did not like her. Now, immediately, I should have been put into some kind of a home or detox or something. But for whatever reason, in 1973, they didn't do that a lot. And so she said, you be ready at 7:30 and we'll be going to that meeting. And she hauled me around these meetings. She belonged to the Pacific Group, and they're kind of a rah-rah group out there, let me tell you. And I was scared to death of everybody and everything. And they were, oh, it was very, very scary. Their meetings were as big as this all the time. It was like I just wanted to melt into the chair someplace. You know, I was shaking, rattling, rolling. They would say, orange juice and honey. Have some orange juice. I mainlined that stuff just to stop the, you know, the shakes. Didn't do any good. I felt as though I had springs like inside of a mattress. It's like this. I was sitting on my hands. Never had a cup of coffee that was more than half full. I mean, you know, I'd have to go. And, you know, that's kind of how I came in. I remember they used to say, you only have to sober up once. Now, I'm sure that there were people going in and out, but I was so obsessed with just trying to sit on my hands. I had no idea what was going on. And I was so scared of Rosemary. She kept yelling at me. She kept saying to me, she said, "What? You're going to have to get sober. You're going to need to get a sponsor. And you have to." And I thought, what's a sponsor? What do you do, interview? I had no idea what they were talking about at all. And she said, a sponsor is somebody, and she said this. She said, it's into the big book in the 12 and 12. And has at least 6 or 7 years of recovery. Now, that's not written anywhere. Do you know that? I'm kind of glad, though, that she told me that. She also told me I was due back in New England for my dad's 75th birthday when I was going to be 37 days sober. And she told me I'd get drunk if I didn't have the sponsor. So I was looking, because I know I didn't want her. I didn't know what it was, but I didn't want her. I knew that much. I often tell this story. I think it was, she brought me to this meeting, and they read a lot out in California, and she told me I was going to read something, and I said no, and she told me, don't say no to an AA request, and I went no. Well, she wouldn't talk to me. She turned around. And I was sure I was being kicked out. And I, you know, they had a coffee break, and I always say this, I have no idea whether they had a coffee break or a cigarette break, because we all smoked in those days and drank coffee right there, I have no idea. But they did in this meeting, and there was a little man that did not go out, and I asked him, I said, can I talk to you? And he said, what's the matter? And I told him, I didn't read, and she's not talking to me, am I kicked out, I didn't know what was going on. He said, how long have you been sober? I said, about a week and a half. And he said to me, the only thing you have to do is not drink and find a meeting you're comfortable in. And thank you, God, for that angel. Thank you, God, for that angel. Some of us can do this. Some can't. For God's sake, give us time to breathe and find out what you're saying. You know, just kind of tag along with us. Do a little 12-step work. Hold on to our hand, for crying out loud. We don't know what the heck's happening when we come in here. Nowadays, you got a lot of knowledge about it, but in those days, there wasn't. There was a woman in the coffee shop after that meeting that said that she went to a little meeting in the West Valley. And she asked me to go the following Thursday, and I met her there, and it was a little room. There was probably maybe 30 people there. It was something called a big book study, so I was thrilled that it might be somebody there that was into the big book, you know. Even though it doesn't say big book, it says Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, big book. I mean, all right, fine. And so, anyway, I'm in that meeting, and after the meeting, I walked up to this man who was selling the big book because he was going to sell it, so I went right up to him. And I asked him, I said, can I have one of those big books? He said, are you new? I said, I am. He said, well, welcome. He said, let me tell you the story I got when I got my big book. He said, when I came into the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a sponsor, and they called him an adversary in those days. And he said, and I got that. He said, you get a big book. And he said, and when you buy that big book, I want to see the receipt because I know you're a thief. And he bought that book, and he read that book, and he went back to Larry Blake, and Larry said, what do you want? And Hugh said, I want to talk to you about what's on the lines in the big book. And Larry said, I'll talk to you about that when you tell me what's on the first page of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So Hugh went back, and he memorized the contents, and that took him a while, and finally he saw Larry, and he recited the contents, and Larry let him do it, and then he said, that's not on the first page. And so then he went back and he looked and he said, oh, Alcoholics Anonymous is on the first page. And so he went back and he said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was over about 3 months or something of doing this. And he finally said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And Larry said, what are you talking about? He said, you told me, if I told you what was on the first page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you'd talk to me about it. And Larry looked at him and he said, listen, young man, he said, there is nothing on the first page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if it's taken you 3 months and you couldn't figure that out, how long is it going to take you to figure out what the black lines of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous are? That's how I got my first big book. Well, I was all excited, because now I had potential sponsorship here, didn't I? So I went back home, and sure enough, Rosemary said to me, did you get a sponsor? And I said, I think I did. She said, are they into the big book? I said, oh, yeah, they're into the big book. She said, good, and walked away. So the next week, I went back to that little meeting, and I walked up to him after the meeting, and he asked me how I was doing, and I said, I have a question. And he said, what? And I said, I was wondering if perhaps maybe you could sponsor me. And he looked down at me and he kind of said, well, he says, you know, he said, since I've gotten married, my wife doesn't cotton to me sponsoring women. He says, but she's that redhead over there and she's got kind of a Mickey Mouse program, but maybe she'll help you out. And I walked over to this woman and I asked her to sponsor me. And she kind of looked down her nose at me and she said, did you just ask my husband to sponsor you? I said, yes, I did. She said, what'd you do that for? So I told her the story. This woman was going to say I was going to get drunk and blah, 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 and I'm shaking. And she probably thought, just released from the nut ward, you know. And she looked at me and she said, you know, honey, she said, I tell you what, you be at my house next Tuesday and you bring the big book and the 12 and 12. And she said, we'll get you back to Massachusetts. And when you come back, you look around. You look for a woman that you want, what she has, and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it. And you ask her to guide you. And I was at her house, and she asked me to tell her my story, and I told her my story, and she said, one day, honey, you're going to tell that in the first person, not the third. I had no idea what she was talking about. Not at all. She said, and one day you'll share those tears. The wall. The mask. What we hide behind. The pain. The disgrace. Of being a woman alcoholic, a mother who's an alcoholic. I remember leaving that place that night, and I can still see her blue eyes. I can still see how she went right through my masks and into my soul. I can still feel the love that was given to me. That woman was my temporary sponsor for 25 years till she died. And her husband sponsored me just as much. I got a kick out of your program here because Hugh Douglas always started his talks with, there is a principle. Which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. And then he would say who he was, and he would preach at you. I do believe for every single one of us nuts, there is a wrench. I hope you're as blessed to find the wrench that I did. I had to have a team for me. I was that sick. But I have 43 years, and I'm going to try to give you some semblance of what it's been like in my journey. I remember from the very beginning, Beverly said to me that I would be in a book study and a 12 and 12 once a week. And there was no excuse in Southern California for that. And so I started my thing. And in the beginning, I chose a little book study in North Hollywood, run by a man called Mike Ross. He was just a giant out there. And he read, you know, two or three pages of the big book, and then we would discuss the black lines. That's how I learned this book. I didn't read a whole chapter or anything. I couldn't even read in those days. You ever try to read when you're that cracked? I mean, you know, really, it's ridiculous. I mean, I was at the bottom of the paragraph. I had no idea what I just said. So it was really nice, it was really nice to be in with these giants that were there at that time. I really feel so blessed. North Hollywood Radford's kind of a special group out there, and I was honored to know a lot of the greats out there. I really was. And I sat at their feet. I really sat at their feet. And I was, you know, New Mexico, but I also have a place in Tampa, and I live in this place, and there's a newcomer. I think anybody in their first 5 years is a newcomer, and she walks around with her other little friend. They're kind of cohorts, you know, they're newly sober, and they'll come by my place, and they'll look to see if I'm in there meditating or whatever, and they're like guppies, and I call them my guppies. And that's just exactly the way I was. I was like a little guppy. I wanted to know what was going on. I didn't understand. There was something going on here. And then I started to hear things. And I made the mistake of listening. Do you know that? You make the mistake of listening. And I remember one time that I had this awareness. I said, oh, my God, what if they're right and I'm wrong? Wow, where did that come from? Around 9 months of recovery, I finally admitted to my innermost self I was alcoholic. I think I was riding on the love. In the beginning, I was riding on the love. And I remember that, I remember this one day that I think was my first conscious contact where I realized that there really is a power. You know, if you seek God, as it says, He'll reveal Himself to you. Do you know that's one of the promises in our book? And so what happened for me was I remember, you know, my case was different. I could get emotionally involved in that first year. And of course, you know, 3 weeks before the big wedding, he decided to go back to live in his cardboard box. I was really crushed. Remember when he got drunk, and in those days you would talk to a wet drunk, and I brought him over there, and I'm crying with Bev, and Bev said, now when you get married in 3 weeks, I don't want to marry him. She said, I'm just checking. Little self will run riot, although I didn't think so. So I was kind of getting over that, you know, that stunts your emotional growth, let me tell you, some of these emotional relationships. And so, anyway, I remember I was there and I was just absolutely a wreck. And I thought, well, I might as well drink. I just want to have a bottle, and I want a bottle of pills, and I want to sit behind the chair, and I want to get drunk. And this voice in my head said, how are you going to thank all those people? Because they had been just carting me around, just doing whatever they could to make sure that I was okay. And I thought, and another voice said, that committee I think Peter was talking about, another voice said, you know, well, you can't thank them. And then this other voice said, yes, you can. And another one said, how? It said, you don't drink. That's how you thank them. You don't drink. And I remember I got up off that bed and I felt as though I must have weighed 500 pounds. And somehow I put one foot in front of the other and ended up over to Radford and went to a meeting. And you know, for years, and I was talking to Jessica about it the other night or the other day or something, you know, out in California they read A Vision for You, page 164, at the end of a meeting. And they, you know, that part where it says, and we trudge this road of happy destiny. And so I went up to the Nest one time to see I used to see her every Saturday night up the Nest, my sponsor. And I walked in there, and she said, "How are you doing?" I said, "I'm crunching my happy road." She said, "I don't think you've looked that word up." Now, I had, because I used a dictionary and I followed direction. And my book said it was like carrying a heavy load. But for some reason, she decided she would tell me what the definition was, which I was really glad because I liked her definition better. And it said, she said, "Trudge means to walk slowly with purpose." Many years later, I moved. You see, I'm a mover. So I moved from there back to New England, up to Maine, and from Maine I've been to Santa Fe, and then I'm back to Maine, and back to Santa Fe. Now I'm in moving red dot. That's it. I just moved no matter what. Anyway, I was sponsoring this person out there in Santa Fe, and they got a big book study, and they got a dictionary dated the same time as the big book. And in that dictionary, it said to walk slowly with purpose. And she was right. There were other things that she told me. She said, always put God first, then you, then other people. I had that all mixed up. I didn't understand that at all. I was absolutely crazy. You were all more important, or my child was. Never, I couldn't get that at all. It took me almost 40 years to realize that's what the fifth step says. We meant to God, to ourselves, and another human being. God, then me, then another human being. I mean, she was just, I thought she was brilliant, you know? How did I learn this book? I learned it a day at a time. There was an old-timer I absolutely loved. His name was Bill Musser. He used to say to me, "You work these steps poorly until you learn to work them well. If you wait to do them perfectly, you'll never do them at all." I'm so grateful for that message. I really am. And through the years, I feel as though I am a seasoned beginner. I still am. And Bev would say things to me such as, "The road gets narrower and the horizon gets broader." I had no idea what she was talking about. I thought that was dopey. I didn't know what it meant. And then eventually, I understood what that meant. You know, when you have 5 years of sobriety, if you're doing the same things you're doing when you're 1 year sober, more than likely you'll get drunk. If you're doing the same things that you're doing at 10 years that you're doing at 5, you're probably going to get drunk. The road gets narrow and the horizon gets broader. In our book, it talks about the fact that the main purpose of the book is to find a power greater than yourself, a God, that will help you solve this problem. And that means that we're going to talk about things that are moral as well as spiritual. And Bev said to me, your drinking is not a moral issue, but your recovery is. I didn't understand what she meant. And as time goes on, I've realized that that's what happens. So the road has gotten narrower and the horizon has gotten broader. What I'm saying to you is that the things and the morals and values I had at 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years are not the values and principles that I live by today. And I am grateful that I do not. That is not something bad. That is something good. And the reason I'm saying that to you is that all 12 steps deal with spiritual tools. They are all tools to find a relationship with your Creator. For years, I felt the only happiness that there was is if I had him, or I had that dress, or I had that car, everything external. Chuck Chamberlain would say, if you look at nature, everything grows from the inside out. It's only the human being trying to get something outside of them to put into them to make them feel better. And so I started to understand when the book told me that deep down inside there was this fundamental idea, and that's where it was going to be found, and that I was going to search diligently within, not without. I'm going in, so I better have a God that I can do business with, it'll do business with me. And for a long time I had an intellectual God, and I did these steps faithfully. Faithfully I did them. And at 20 years of recovery, I had more fear than I had when I came in because I knew what the black line said. And I couldn't understand why I was so fearful. Why am I so fearful at 20 years of recovery? I should have all my stuff together. You know, I know what these lines say. I know every page, you name it, I knew it. But you see, there's a difference between knowing it and understanding it. And Hugh Douglas used to say to me, "You know this stuff, but you don't understand it." And I said, how do I get to understand it? He said, you do it. You walk this. You don't talk this. This is a program of attraction, not promotion. It's a better demonstration. A better demonstration of these principles are in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. How is this being demonstration? It doesn't say we practice the steps. It says we practice the principles in all our affairs. It wasn't until I understood that there were principles behind each step. You know, what areas of my life am I not being honest? Where am I not open-minded? Where am I not willing? Where don't I have courage? Where don't I have integrity? Where am I not ready? Where don't I have, you know, humility? What, these are things and questions that I can ask myself. I didn't understand that the values I had after my first every fourth step I've ever done has given me hope. But this continues. For a long time, I thought I should arrive someplace. And what I had done at 20 years is I had developed the God of Reason. I didn't understand that. If you look at the Beatitudes on page 52 and you ask those statements, turn them into questions, you say, am I having trouble with personal relationships? You know, there's 8 statements there. Turn them into questions. But there was this one guy, I didn't like him very much, because I thought I was doing well. I said, I'm doing okay. I can make a living. I'm not prey to misery. I'm not on, you know, shaken and being scared or anything. But then he said, ask the question this way. Has God brought you as far as he can in regard to personal relationships? And immediately I said, God, I hope not. And I said that to each one of those. God, I hope not. So why did I just tell you I was doing okay? And then I said, God, I hope not. And then I started to understand that I had a God of Reason, because I compared it to when I had come in 40 years ago or 20 years, whatever, didn't make any difference, whatever time. And compared to that, I was doing a lot better. But I didn't think that, I thought there was more. And I had limited the power that is in these rooms. Please don't do what I did. Please don't do what I did. I found it on page 129 when it said something to the effect of, Father had struck something better than gold. It's a limitless load. It's limitless. And it's going to pay me dividends as long as I mine it for the rest of my life and insist on giving the whole thing away. Don't stop. Don't stop. It tells me in my book, I think it's on page 13 and 42, it talks about the fact if I practice these, if I have a spiritual program, it'll solve all my problems, not just my alcohol. Thank God. Because it says elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. It's just a beginning. And there's a whole life here. There's a whole journey that you need to feel and experience and have the honor of meeting and trudging, walking slowly with purpose through some of the certain trials and low spots ahead. And some of us who have been around a while know that those happen, but we never have to do it alone. And there will be people that you will find that have that same look that Sybil had, that my sponsors had, that a wonderful man by the name of Don Pritz had. You could look into their eyes and you'd just know that you're safe. It was kind of like Bill when he saw Ebby, and he said something had gotten into him. He had a change of heart. Didn't say anything about our mind, did it? We don't claim intellectual enlightenment in this program. We claim spiritual progress. Where am I today? How have I been with my best friend today? I too stole from Bill's story one day. I realized, what is my God of my understanding? I've changed that to the God of my experience. I turn my will and my lives over to the care of my best friend. It's a feeling, it's an experience that I have, that I know that is safe and I feel connected. I have had the privilege of doing a lot in this program. I really have. I don't know. Am I done? I never know what time it is. Is it time? God, it's time, isn't it?
Keep talking.
Well, I'm done. I don't know. God, am I done? That daughter grew up. I just want to kind of tell you that experience. My daughter grew up, and we had a very rough time. I was 5 years in recovery when I realized I really wanted to be a mother. Big of me, she was 15 by then. And, I realized that I didn't have any idea on how to be a parent. And so I did a lot of stuff, and some people have heard my earlier tapes on what I've done. But basically, that has been an off and on relationship. And I got to a point where I had a very hard time between 28 to 32 years. There was a lot of shattering of belief structures, and I think that's why I so know that if I have a relationship with my best friend, I'm going to be all right. I really am, and I'm grateful for that. Because through these trials and low spots, we really do get closer to that God. And it was a very bad time, and my daughter was in Japan. She works for the military. Big job. And I went to visit her, and it was a very hard time. She told me she never wanted to see me unless there was some kind of a function going on. It's kind of hard to take when you get about 30-something years of recovery. I don't blame her, though. I've done enough inventory to realize I didn't deserve being called Mom. So I went home and I did even more inventory and stuff, and I really got to a place with the 10th step that I like the 10th step promises more than any other promises. I didn't understand that when you finally do those first 9 and you enter the world of the spirit, that means that you're on a different level. It means that when we're not feeling, when we feel fear and all the rest of those things, I got so tired of trying to figure out, is this selfish? I finally just said, am I in a place of neutrality? No. Then ask God to remove whatever it is. I mean, I can't do this intellectual stuff until the 11th step when I constructively review my day. So during the day when I'm not feeling in a place of neutrality, I usually start just say, hey, God, I don't think I feel too good. Do you think maybe you could help me out? Anyways, I had those promises come true. She came to visit me on a function, and, you know, I did something that I shouldn't have done, and she decided to scream at me about it. And long story short, I remember I was sitting there, and I said, oh, God, what am I supposed to do? And out of my mouth came this, you know, you're right, Candace, I'm wrong. I just assumed because of such and such that this was happening, and that was wrong, to assume I didn't ask you. And I said, I was wrong. She didn't know what to do. And I just went on. I responded naturally, normally. It was just absolutely unbelievable. Later, the same thing happened with another topic, and I finally, that was it. The following year, she called, and she said, where are you going to be? Are you going to be in, this was about 9 years ago. She said, are you going to be in New Mexico or Maine? I said, I'll be up in Maine then. She said, well, I'll come visit you. And I said, okay. She arrived, and she proceeded to tell me that she had 7 months in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. I said, you want to talk to me about it? And she told me. And at the end, she said, I'm so glad you didn't say I was saving you a seat. And I said, honey, I said, the last inventory I did, I realized I have no idea who you are. You left home when you were about 17. You're 45 now, sweetie. I said, I have no idea who you are. I've never spent any time to listen to who you are, and I'm sorry for that. A couple of years ago, I spoke down to Fots South in Lafayette. She came. Little did I know that the hostess had told her to introduce me. And she stood up there, and she proceeded to introduce me, tell everybody she'd known me for almost 50 years, and I'm not the same person that I was. And then she went on to say, because of the demonstration of spirituality from my mother, I knew that when I needed something, that this was the place to come to. You see what you gave me? Do you understand it's a demonstration? I stopped promoting. I started to just do it. It's not about that. It's about how we live. I wish you all the pain. I wish you all the joy. I wish you all the tears, and I wish you all the laughter. And the reason for that is because that's life. Before, I never allowed any feelings. I close my talks the same way, page 68, just to the extent I humbly rely upon my best friend and do as I believe God would have me do. Will he enable me to match calamity with serenity? Thank you, and God bless.